All right. So I'm going to try and give you a sort of a broad overview of the sort of the role of behavior in cancer and cancer, mainly in terms of cancer risk, but then go into a little bit more about, you know, sort of theories of health behavior and health behavior change. They give you a context of how you can intervene to change behavior and how you can set up studies in order to understand behavioral processes. So that's in a nutshell what I'm going to talk about, explain the role of behavior in etiology and treatment of cancer, explain theories of health behavior and health behavior change. Along the way, we'll get into issues related to measurement and health behavior. So the reason they give me a whole lecture to talk about this is because, you know, cancer is a disease in humans. Humans are imperfect creatures, and they do all sorts of things that are bad for them. And so, you know, behaviors come in terms of being risk factors for cancer. So, you know, people smoke, people drink, people have unprotected sex. They do things that are that will increase their exposure to things that cause cancer. Behavior also plays a role in terms of protective or preventative factors, so using sunscreen, getting proper screening, compliance with medication, how people seek information about their health. All of these things can be thought of as more protective behaviors. So the behavioral issues aren't just about cancer risk. They're also about cancer prevention and risk reduction. So, give you a sense of scale for this. So, if you add up all of the cancers that are attributable to tobacco use, that adds up to about a third of all cancer deaths. Physical inactivity and poor diet account for about 30%, and there's some overlap between those two. So, you're probably looking at somewhere on the order of 40 to 50% is accounted for by the top two bullets here. So if you could design really good health promotion interventions that would reduce tobacco use and increase physical activity and consumption of healthy diets, you would reduce cancer burden massively. And that's not to say that people haven't tried. The issue with, you know, changing health behaviors is that it's really hard. And part of what I'll get into in the course of the lecture today is try and give you an understanding for how hard it can be and ways that you can sort of increase the effectiveness of interventions. another thing to think about is other things that reduce the risk of cancer or promote early detection at a point where cancer is treatable. Getting people to get mammograms, getting people to get colonoscopies, things like PSA, digital rectal exam, other things, pap smears, HPV vaccination, all of these things involve getting people to understand information and change behavior. So, you want to get more granular. So smoking accounts for about a third of all cancer deaths. This is why. It's strongly associated with lung cancer, an oral cancer, tracheal cancer. But it's also associated with cancers in sites that you wouldn't necessarily expect just based on breathing smoke into your lungs. So smoking is a leading factor in bladder cancer, esophageal, kidney cancer, pancreatic, cervical, colon, leukemias, particularly AML, and stomach cancer. So those are a large distributed cancer burden, likely because you're taking in lots of different carcinogens that are generated from combustion, and they travel throughout the body. They find their favorite sites where they interact with body tissue to promote DNA damage. Smokeless tobacco is sort of associated with less of the cancer burden. Primarily, it's associated with oral cancer and pancreatic cancer. And the there's a relative risk of oral cancer for smoking and smokeless tobacco use are approximately equivalent. They can also have synergistic effects, but people who smoke and use smokeless tobacco tend to be at an even more increased risk of oral cancer relative to people who only use one. Physical inactivity seems to be associated most prominently with colon and breast cancers. Alcohol use tends to be associated with oral cancer, esophageal, and liver cancers. Alcohol use also has synergistic effects with smoking, such to significantly increase the risk of oral cancer. So for people who have high alcohol consumption and also smoke, tend to have a substantially increased risk of oral cancer. So risky sexual activity, particularly unprotected sex, seems to be associated with cervical cancer. HPV is the link there. Also associated with oral cancers, again, also largely due to HPV exposure. low fruit and vegetable consumption associated with breast, colorectal, oral, laryngeal, esophageal, and stomach cancers. Increasing fruit and vegetables consumption tends to mitigate these risks. Similarly with obesity, there's sort of a significant overlap between obesity and low fruit and vegetable consumption and physical activity. And then tanning or excessive sun or UV exposure tends to be associated with melanoma. So if you're a behavioral interventionist, what you want to do is change as many of these as you can in a positive direction. So get people to stop using tobacco, be physically active, minimize use of alcohol, and eat more fruits and vegetables, lose weight, and avoid a whole lot of sun exposure. I like this graph too, despite the fact that it's a little dense. Because this gives you the sense of scale. So I'm running down the x-axis here are different sites. So tracheal, lung, and bronchial, and lung cancer. So this is basically the number of deaths caused by lung, tracheal, and bronchial cancer broken out for men and women. The striped bars are the proportion of those deaths that are attributable to the underlying behavior. And then the rest are, you know, caused by, are attributable to other causes. So the vast majority of lung cancer is attributable to the bad disease. A good chunk of stomach cancer is attributable to poor diet. So all of these striped bars are, you know, sort of behaviorally attributable deaths, essentially. So almost all of cervical cancer, a fair chunk of oral cancers. Whereas you look at something like breast cancer, a lot of the bar is, you know, solid color. So it's attributable to sort of non-behavioral risk factors. So, you know, things like BRCA1, BRCA2 mutations, other exposures in family history, other genetic predisposition. So, shifting gears a bit, one of the ways you want to think about, you know, sort of designing interventions, understanding the association between cancer and behavioral risk factors is, you know, coming up with a theoretical framework that explains how all of these things relate to each other. And, you know, by creating a theoretical framework, you're sort of making a statement about the importance of underlying relationships. And it lets you focus attention on certain factors that you think are particularly important or that are relatively easy to study. And, you know, by implication, it allows you to ignore others or treat them as equal across everybody. But models then force you to make explicit causal assumptions. So you sort of have to lay your cards on the table and say, I think that this behavior leads to this exposure, which leads to this outcome. And what are the factors that underlie the behavior? And so if you want to sort of understand why people do what they do, you need to come up with a plausible set of antecedents to that behavior and then design your intervention so that they affect certain parts of the model. So I'll walk you through a bunch of examples for this. It's also important to think that while a lot of the examples I'll give you focus on the individual, individuals don't exist in a vacuum. They are embedded in social structures. And people have individual levels of knowledge, attitudes, skills, but they're interconnected with people, sort of at an intimate level from families, friends, and their sort of closer social networks. And these function to transmit information, to encourage or discourage certain behaviors, and, basically providing a support system for you to encourage behavior change, both positively and negatively. But even those more intimate social systems are embedded within larger social systems. So people are embedded within communities, neighborhoods, states. And you can think of the overall culture of the state. Can be either, it can be a community that promotes health, has a walkable environment, has access to lots of fruits and vegetables, has parks, has lots of fresh foods available, generally doesn't have a lot of tobacco outlets, or you can have a community that's not very walkable, that has very few places to buy healthy foods, that has a relative high density of tobacco outlets. And people in community A may generally tend to have, better health, healthier behaviors than people living in community B. Even if they themselves don't differ a whole lot in terms of knowledge, attitudes, or even intentions to change behavior. So while a lot of the models I'll talk through and the examples I'll talk through are sort of focused on the individual and may touch on the interpersonal level, these people are embedded within a larger structure that also bears attention. So, in thinking about health behavior models, there's sort of a couple of broad classes. Some of the more common ones that get used a lot for interventions and studying the dynamics of health behavior in particular are, sort of cognitive theories that really focus on information and information processing. So things like the health belief model, which really posit that your decisions about your health come back to a balance between what you believe your risks are and what you think the benefits of engaging in a behavior are. And to a certain extent, subjective expected utility theory is very similar to this, in that you're basically weighing risks and benefits and coming to a decision about the behavior that you choose to engage in generally carries more benefit to you than risk. Behavioral intention models are somewhat similar, but they focus more on whether you believe you can and will perform a behavior. So they sort of take one step back, and you don't ask what have you done, but really what will you do in the future. And intention models can be useful to study behavior that may not necessarily happen in the here and now, but may require you to change things in the short and medium term before an actual change occurs. Another class of models goes back to much more psychologically based balance of reward and punishment, so stimulus response type theories. So in other words, do you have a reinforcer, and is the behavior that you're engaged in particularly reinforcing? So a lot of theories of addiction stroll out of stimulus response theory. So that, you know, drugs of abuse are particularly rewarding, and so the ability of people to stop using drugs of abuse, including nicotine, is driven in large part by the rewarding effects that people get from using it in the short term, even given negative consequences that are much more diffuse and down the road. I really won't go into that here today, but it's another class of behaviors that is potentially informative if you're really looking in changing of behaviors where the negative behavior is particularly reinforcing. Another broad class of theories that were known as social learning theories. So these mainly focus, rather than, theories up here are much more about information, providing information and context. Social learning theories are much more focused on social influence and expectations. So, for example, in a social learning theory, one would be interested particularly in the environment that somebody is embedded. So, if you ever took Psych 101 and you learned about Albert Bandura and the Bobo Dolls, a key part of social learning theory is known as vicarious reinforcement, which means that you can learn behaviors by watching other people do them. So, does everybody know the Bandura Bobo Doll study? This is a classic. So, in the late 50s, early 60s, Albert Bandura, psychologist at Stanford, he was studying aggression in children, and he wanted to understand sort of the source of aggression in little kids. And so the experiment he did is he put, he was observing kids through a one-way mirror in a room, and he had a condition where a research confederate, like an RA, came in, and there was this, stand-up inflatable doll in the room. And in some conditions, the experimenter would go over and, say, oh, I like this doll, and just pat it on the head. Or other conditions, you would ignore it totally. And then in other conditions, you would come in and wail at it. And the kids ended up doing whatever the experimenter did. So when the experimenter left the room, the kids were left alone in the room with the Bobo doll. The kids who saw the experimenter wailing on it went over and hit it. And the kids who saw the experimenter behaved in a sort of a neutral manner to it, either left it alone or behaved in a more appropriate way. And absent any other influence, that suggests that the primary antecedent of the kids beating up the doll was watching an adult beat up the doll. So, social learning theory interventions grow out of this and suggest that you need role models and significant people to model pro-health behaviors in a way that will engage people in trying to change their own behavior. So this underlies a lot of advertising where you see testimonials of people saying that this worked for me, and those are playing on themes that emerge from things like social learning. And then another class of models really deal with the macro social influence in, broadly speaking, diffusion of innovation. So, a current example of this could be like electronic cigarettes. So these are products that, you know, have sort of rapidly been taken up in the population, and they started at a relatively low level. Generally, if innovations tend to follow an S-curve, where you have relatively low adoption among sort of what you might call innovators, who then, through their social networks and their broader communities, diffuse information about this particular innovation to other people who then take it up, and that causes prevalence of use to go up at a relatively rapid rate. And then it'll eventually plateau, and so the people who either adopted very late or never at all would be generally considered to be laggards. But so you can think of e-cigarettes as an example of that, but even diffusion of things like HPV vaccination can be studied in terms of how the people who adopted early influence the people who adopted much later on in the cycle. And their experiences can be influential in driving other people to adopt it or not. So one example is the theory of reasoned action, which is a behavioral theory basically that posits that behavior is best predicted from your intention to perform that behavior. So in other words, you've made some sort of commitment that you want to do it, and that's the best short-term indicator of what you'll actually do it down the road. I can tell you as a behavioral scientist, it's much easier to measure intention than it is to measure behavior. And intention is underlined by two factors. One is your attitude about the behavior, and the second is the social norms surrounding that behavior. So attitude is basically whether you think the behavior is on balance, good or bad. You can measure that in a whole bunch of subdomains. And social norms, which I'll get into a little bit more detail later, are do you think generally most people approve or disapprove of this? An extension of this, it's called the theory of planned behavior, which takes this model and adds another component, which is behavioral control, which is the belief that you have and can exercise control over your own behavior. So in other words, it takes this concept of I may have all the best intentions to perform the behavior, but I don't perceive that I either have the proper skills or I don't have I'm not in the correct environment, for example, to actually go ahead and perform the behavior. And control seems to be an important component, or perceived control seems to be an important component in driving people to make particularly difficult behavioral changes. So if you want to illustrate this out, you think of behavior on the far right-hand side. That's undergirded by behavioral intention, so the degree to which you think you're going to do it, or you really want to do it. And that's influenced separately by attitudes, subjective norms, and perceived behavioral control. So these concepts are all measurable, in a sense. You can ask people what they believe about, say, getting screened for colon cancer. You can ask them, in terms of the evaluation of behavioral outcomes, do you think it's a good or bad thing for you to get screened? What do you think the screening would find? And what you do if the screening were positive? Normative beliefs, things like, do most people in your family or in your community get screened? Motivation to comply. Would you want to get screened? these other concepts like control beliefs and perceived power. Control beliefs would be things like, I believe I have the resources to get somewhere to get screened. And perceived power would be, I feel as though I can talk to my doctor about getting screened. So, doing a little bit of a deeper dive into this model. The attitude is really a function of your belief that doing the behavior will lead to a particular outcome, and that outcome being good or bad. So, you can have a positive attitude towards the eventual outcome, or you can have a negative attitude. And those attitudes are also malleable. So you could have somebody who starts out with a negative attitude, provide some sort of an informational intervention or provide a demonstration, and you can then shift the attitude. And if you shift the attitude, that should downstream influence intention. Told you to do a bit of a deeper dive on social norms. So these are important because they really reflect the behavioral expectations and cues within the society or group. So not just for the individual. The individual, when you measure social norms in an individual, you're getting their perception of the norm. And they're embedded within a particular social structure, like I showed you before. So the norm per se comes from the social structure. And these are really customary rules of behavior that coordinate interactions within that social context. So, in general, when you defer to a social norm within a particular social context, you're maintaining your acceptance and popularity within that group. And ignoring social norms risks you becoming unacceptable or an outcast. So, so if you think of, you know, what the social norms are, say, when you're in college, you probably have one set of behaviors that's acceptable, and when you're at home, you have another set of behaviors that's acceptable. And you know, sometimes those overlap and sometimes those don't. But adhering to the social norm within those particular social contexts is important. If you want a exercise in social norming, get on an elevator and stand backwards. So social norm in our immediate context is you walk into an elevator and you turn around and face the door. If you want to make people really uncomfortable, walk into an elevator and face the back. And really what you're doing, you're violating a social norm. So it's a fun exercise in social psychology, so I encourage people to try it. But social norms really are something that you have to keep in the back of your mind, because if you're trying to engage people in behavior change or get people to do something, but it's not something that would be normally socially acceptable within their circle, it makes it that much harder for them to change. So you've got two broad classes of norms. You've got the behavioral norm, which is if you objectively measure it, these are the most common actions or behaviors exhibited in a social group. So it's most people actually do. And then you have the attitudinal norm, which is the shared belief or expectations about how people ought to behave. So you can think of one as sort of normative behavior and the other one as sort of the perceived norm, or what people think people are doing. And these don't necessarily always line up. So an example of this is, if you ask high school kids what proportion of kids smoke, drink, do drugs, what proportion of people your age do all of these things, they will almost invariably give you higher numbers than actually are measured. And the bigger the deviation between the proportion that you think you're doing it and the proportion who are actually doing it is a pretty good predictor of whether you'll go on to do it. And if you think about it, it makes a lot of sense, because if you perceive yourself to be outside of the norm, then that would actually motivate you to do it. So understanding the social norm is important to if you're trying to shape people's behavior and trying to move them towards pro-health behaviors and away from negative health behaviors. Sort of a good example of this is in tobacco control, which is my home field. One of the great policy successes in tobacco control has been the denormalization of smoking. So if you look, if we had been in this room 50 years ago, I probably would have been up here smoking, and most of you probably would have been smoking while you were listening to me. It's a sea change in sort of behavioral science that, you know, we have a behavior that was once very widespread, was not isolated by particular social classes, and was heavily promoted. And the large degree of that success has been to denormalize behavior. So focusing your attention on not smoking rather than saying smokers are bad people. So there's a distinction to be made between denormalization, or changing the social norm around smoking, versus stigmatizing people for smoking. So they're not the same thing. There is a danger that you can cross from denormalization into stigma. And this has been raised a few times, where if you cross that line, it can actually be counterproductive. Because stigma implies that you're not just outside the norm, but that you're deviant or abnormal. And that's a bad thing in the context of trying to promote health. And so, for example, in the classic case of where stigma has been studied related to health and HIV, and, you know, the degree to which you perceive HIV to be a stigmatized disease leads people to not seek testing or treatment. So, it is important to sort of understand that, you know, changing a social norm doesn't necessarily coincide with trying to stigmatize behavior. It means you're trying to shift the expectations in the social structure. You're not trying to demonize a particular group of people. And this is important to keep in mind in, you know, particularly in tobacco control, because smoking is increasingly clustered among socially disadvantaged groups. So groups that are already somewhat marginalized. And so you're adding to that if you shift from merely shifting social norms to, you know, piling on, as it were. So keeping in mind the importance of social norms and shifting behavior, you can think about an example. This is the paper I gave to Reed. So looking at cervical cancer screening, so getting pap smears in this case. So screening for cervical cancer decreases incidence and mortality. It's fairly well established finding. The recommended screening, at least at the time the study was done, was having pap smears every 3 years starting age 21. There are important disparities in lung cancer screening and cervical cancer screening, such that cervical cancer incidence is significantly higher in Latinas, and this group is also much more likely to have never been screened. So you have high incidence and you have relatively low levels of screening. So you have an opportunity to change behavior in order to drive incidence down. So the paper that I assigned is really a direct application of the theory of planned behavior to predict cervical cancer screening. So it was a good example to walk you through exactly how all this stuff works. So the data here come from an intervention trial where they were looking at lay health workers to deliver information about cancer screening to Latina women. So the women in the study were age 21 and older, of Mexican origin, had no previous history of cancer and no cervical cancer screening within the past 3 years, because they were targeting people who hadn't been screened, because what you want them to do, you want them to get screened. And they recruit people from a variety of locations to try and get a reasonably representative sample. And this is where behavioral science and bench science go opposite directions. We find people at beauty salons and laundromats and churches, and the mice are just across the street. So the point here is you've got to go out and find these people and get them engaged. So looking at the demographics of the sample, most are married. The vast majority have completed less than high school. Most were immigrants. Very few had health insurance, and most of them primarily spoke Spanish. So another lesson as somebody doing an intervention, you want to know this first. So you want to know what your target population is like, because if you showed up and you had your very nice glossy English language brochures and you tried to intervene in this population, it wasn't going anywhere. So, I realize there's numbers and stuff everywhere, I'll walk you through it. But, so what they have here is an actual longitudinal study. So, the intention actually predates the behavior, because they could verify whether people got cancer screening or not. So, in this case, intention is a significant predictor of cancer screening. So, intention measured at 0.1, significantly predicted actually getting cancer screening, I believe it was 6 months later, with an effect size of 0.28. And another thing about behavioral science is you do jumping jacks over effect sizes that big, because behavior change is really hard. And, you know, if you increase the screening rate from 30% to 50%, you're golden. That's a huge effect size in behavior change. So, what were the underlying factors that were particularly important? So, remember, they have an intervention here. They have lay health workers talking to people and trying to get them to understand the importance of cancer screening, and also to understand what factors are driving them towards or away from it. So overall, attitudes weren't really a significant predictor of intention in this case, but they expressed their primary attitudes were negative. So particularly important attitudinal things were concerns about pain, about worry about what the test might find, and you know, embarrassment in general from going to get the test. But the particularly salient predictors of intention were subjective norm and perceived behavioral control. So the norm was a relatively strong predictor, and the most important factors underlying norms were whether they had family members who had been screened, whether they had friends who were encouraging them to get screened, and whether they had ever had a doctor tell them they should get screened. So these are all important things to understand. You know, the social network can be a really important driver of behavior. it's also important to look at behavioral control. So these are all measures of their belief that they could schedule their next pap smear down the road, that they were able to make an appointment, and that they could plan for regular pap smears going into the future. So to the extent to which you thought that you could plan for these things and do them moving forward was a significant predictor of you actually intending to and doing them. What's interesting in this particular model is that this works in the sense of all of these effects flow through intention. The direct effects of these on actual cancer screening behavior down the line are relatively small and non-significant. So, in this case, everything is washing through intention. So they concluded from this that for successful interventions in this subpopulation, you would need to, the big variable is increasing sense of control over the process. And including messages that strengthen beliefs that people who are important to them expect them to go under their screening. So increasing that injunctive norm. But they concluded that the model demonstrated that increasing intention will positively affect screening behavior. So you did get that intention behavior link. And that the model, therefore, was useful in sort of describing the effectiveness of an intervention, which is a good way to sort of illustrate that why we go through these elaborate models is to understand, well, okay, if this didn't work, we could tweak X, Y, and Z and see if that works. So, another example is colorectal cancer screening. And this one is a particularly sticky problem because, getting screened for colorectal cancer is no fun. But screening for and removing polyps is the best way to prevent colorectal cancer. And the best way to screen for polyps is to do colonoscopies. And people don't like getting colonoscopies. So around age 50, you've got 25% risk of developing adenomatous polyps. By age 75, you're up to 50 to 75% risk. So you want to start screening before age 50, and then getting them every 10 years thereafter. That's the current recommendation. If you're particularly high familial risk, you may start earlier. But in general, the recommendation is a colonoscopy every 10 years, unless you find a polyp, in which case the window gets reduced. But here you've got both screening and early detection going on at the same time. So if you find a polyp, you're decreasing cancer incidence. And by detecting this early, you're also decreasing mortality. So you're getting sort of two bangs for your buck. Because if you take the polyp out, it can't turn into cancer. And so you get both decreased incidence and mortality. Now, there's other ways to do cancer screening that are considered acceptable modalities, including fecal occult blood tests and the FIT test, which is an immunochemical test. But ultimately, they all flow to colonoscopy. So in other words, if you have a positive FOBT or FIT test, you're getting a colonoscopy, because that's the gold standard. But sometimes it's easier to get people to do an FOBT or a FIT test, and if you have a negative FIT test, it's very unlikely that you need a colonoscopy. So the question is, if you've got more people to do FIT tests, would that overall increase screening, decrease incidence, decrease mortality to the same extent as if you've got everybody to go get colonoscopies? And the issue with colonoscopy, too, is that it's not easy to do. They have practical barriers in terms of the capacity of the health system to accommodate large numbers of people getting colonoscopies. Because it requires an endoscopy suite, it requires a physician to do it, it requires anesthesia, and it's not without its own risk. Because you, in relatively rare cases, can perforate the colon. So it's not something that you want everybody to do if they don't really need to do it. It's also, because of all of that, it's also costly. It's not necessarily to the person themselves, but to the system more broadly. You also have access issues. So some people may live relatively far away from a provider who would be able to do one, or a facility that would be able to support colonoscopy. And so in those cases, getting more people to do FIT tests or FOBTs would increase screening overall without increasing burden on a health facility. And then on the person side, you've also got psychological and social barriers. So, knowledge of awareness of the risk factors for colorectal cancer, not knowing whether you have a family history of it or not, and in particular here, negative attitudes towards screening. So, think about this as a model for how you get people to do an FOBT or a FIT test. Well, behavior is you're collecting and returning a stool sample to the GP. There's a whole lot of people who don't want to do that. It's kind of gross. But you got to do it if you want to do a FIT test. So understanding people's beliefs about, you know, what the benefits and rewards are, what normative beliefs are, what their motivation to comply is, understanding all of these factors in the theory of planned behavior can help you drive people's intention to collect and perform a FIT test. So, one study that looked at, you know, whether people were randomized to a biennial FIT test, so a FIT test every other year versus getting a colonoscopy. And they had 53,000 subjects aged 50 to 69 with a primary outcome of mortality at 10 years. And if you look at this, so you get a relatively you get much higher adherence to the FIT test than you do to colonoscopy. So more people are willing to do the FIT test than are willing to get a colonoscopy. In both groups, you find more adenomas in the colonoscopy group than you do in the FIT test because colonoscopy is designed to find those. FIT test is testing for blood, which then has to be confirmed by a colonoscopy. And you've got relatively low rates of actual pathologically confirmed cancer. So in screening that many people, you're not going to find that many cases. So the problem in the study is that recommending only colonoscopy resulted in lower adherence to the recommendation. So what they followed this up with was a randomized trial where you offered colonoscopy, FOBT, or your choice of the two. And then follow those people up for 12 months to see how many people went and did it within that year. So if you offer people FOBT only, you get about 65% of them go out and do it within the year. If you only offer people colonoscopy, less than 40% of them actually go out and do it. But if you give them a choice, almost 70% of them go out and do one of them. Which one do you think they actually did? FOBG. But the important thing is that, you know, that many more people got screened because you gave them the option. And so recognizing people's preferences in some ways gives them that sense of control, that they have a choice in deciding which direction they want to go, rather than, oh, here's your option, you can get a colonoscopy or not. If you say, you can get a FOBT or you can get a colonoscopy, the choice landscape there is different than saying colonoscopy, yes or no. It's, you're getting screened, which one of these do you want? So, shifting gears a little bit, I want to talk a bit about theories of behavior change. So, in particular, changing behaviors that require much long-term maintenance. So, largely I'm talking about things like screening, where it's a go or no-go event. You either do it or you don't. Other behaviors like quitting smoking, like changing diets, changing exercise patterns, aren't simple yes-no events. They're outcomes that people can gear up and change the degree to which they're adherent to it. They can change the intensity with which they do it, and they can relapse. So they can go from good behavior to bad behavior to good behavior over and over again. So understanding these kinds of behavioral patterns requires a little bit of a different focus. So one I liked pretty well is what's known as the trans-theoretical model. And this really looks at behavior change as a process rather than an event. So if you think of the theory of planned behavior, you're really looking at event-type behaviors. Here we're looking at processes of behavior. And you can think of it as, you know, some people think of it as 5 or 6 distinct stages of change. Where you can move from pre-contemplation through contemplation, through preparation, action, maintenance, and some people add termination, and some people consider termination sort of part of maintenance. But whether you consider it 5 or 6, the real thing that sets the TTM apart from things like theory of planned behavior is that this is more of a circular model than a linear model. So people can cycle between these stages readily. And in theory, you can move backwards. So as a way to illustrate, so when you're in pre-contemplation, you're really, you know, it's literally what it says. You're not really thinking about behavior change. You're sort of happy to do what you're doing. Contemplation means that you've sort of accepted that you need to change behavior, and you may be thinking about ways that you might do that. In preparation, the key here is that you've made a plan. You have some sort of concrete willingness to change, and come up with some ways to do that. In action, you're actually doing it. Quitting smoking, you've made a commitment to quit, you stop smoking. That's action phase. But the real, people can move relatively rapidly through these initial stages. The real root of the problem is here, maintenance and real. So, if you're trying to eat a healthier diet and you're going to increase your fruit and vegetable consumption, it's not really doing you a whole lot of good to do that at one meal. It's suffusing that through your entire diet And that's really what's in the maintenance phase. It's how you change your lifestyle in ways that promote the new behavior that you're trying to encourage. And when the new behavior falls back into older patterns, then you're getting into relapse. And having strategies to move back from relapse into maintenance is the core of how you intervene in populations to sort of maintain behavior changes. And the transthyretical model really came out of the smoking cessation literature, but it's been more widely applied to a lot of hard-to-change relapsing behaviors, so things like diet, exercise, medication adherence. If you think about how these map on to other theories, if you think about pre-contemplation, contemplation, preparation, these sort of fall within the broad domain of behavioral intention. So it's what you're thinking about doing to change your behavior. Whereas preparation, action, maintenance is much more about the performance of the behavior. So I showed you, you've got this big circle, and you've got, you know, sort of transitions within these stages, how you get there. There's a whole bunch of what are known as processes of change, and I won't get into the minutiae here, but there are a whole bunch of different ways that you can use strategies to increase people's propensity to change and to sort of evaluate their own behaviors. And you'll see a little bit of this as I walk you through the example. It'll be easier to explain with something concrete. So, you think about decisional balance is really about pros and cons of behavior change. Dramatic relief is one that's particularly salient in smoking cessation and also in diet. So, experiencing negative emotions that go along with old behaviors and positive associations with new behavior. So what you're trying to do is the old behavior is associated with bad things and the new behavior is associated with good things. And trying to get people to sort of mentally separate the two. Social liberation is sort of maps on the concepts of social norms, that your social norm has changed or you're in a new dynamic which is much more supportive of your new behavior. So now much supportive of having quit smoking or eating your healthier diet. And so these map on at various stages within the stages of change as they become much more relevant. So certain things are much more relevant to maintenance, whereas others are more relevant to getting you towards change. So, it's the last thing I'll walk you through. So, very recent paper that looked at a smoking cessation intervention delivered over Facebook. And in this particular paper, they were looking at the particular content that drove the most engagement among the people on the social network. So they built their intervention around the transtheoretical model. And so they had messages that were designed for people in specific stages, pre-contemplation, contemplation, preparation. And they wanted to see, okay, what content was the most engaging for people so that you could then say, okay, well, this set of messages seems to be particularly effective, this other set seems to be not, so just dump that and focus on these. So all of these went to a private Facebook group tailored to their stage of change. So that means that all of the information that they saw was geared to people who were in pre-contemplation, so they weren't yet ready to quit, contemplation, people who are thinking about quitting or preparation, getting ready to quit. And so the staff were making a single Facebook post every day for 90 days. So I hate to be the grad student who was doing this every day, typing this out. So they had 586 people took the invitation, 230 signed the consent, and 79 were assigned to one of the 7 Facebook groups. And this is the other reality of behavioral science. You started out with 586 and you ended up with 79. But you have about 13 participants per group and a mean age of 21. Most of them were male, which was kind of odd, I thought, but age certainly reflects the user profile in Facebook. So what they were doing here is they were looking at the number of comments back as an index of engagement. And what they saw is that, you know, for the pre-contemplators, by and large, they were commenting in the first, you know, 30, 45 days, and then it starts to tail off. In the contemplators, it's really heavy in the first few days, and then it majorly tails off. And then in the preparation folks, it's almost all in the first 50 days, and then, you know, basically goes to nothing. But what was particularly interesting was if the people were in contemplation or pre-contemplation, there was more engagement when the posts were focused on decisional balance, so that weighing of the pros and cons of quit. Mm-hmm. And then for participants who were in the contemplation phase, posts that utilized dramatic relief or self-liberation themes had below average engagement. So in other words, they were not really driving people to comment. And what they theorized was that the dramatic relief posts that they used were primarily focused on negative emotions related to smoking. And what they thought was if they had done the opposite and had posts that focused on the positives of quitting, or the positive emotional effects of quitting, might have been much more effective. And this ties into a whole other literature on what's known as gain-framed versus loss-framed messages. In other words, do you emphasize what you're losing by continuing to smoke, or do you emphasize what you gain by quitting? And in general, that literature points to if you have people who are already motivated to quit, focusing on the gains is more effective. You have people who are not motivated to quit, focusing on the losses is more effective. So, for those of you who are interested in this stuff, and I hope I've at least piqued somebody's interest in behavioral science, we've got a whole panoply of people who do this sort of thing in different areas, primarily in tobacco control, but also in health communications and health disparities more broadly. And you know, if any of you are interested in behavioral research, I'm sure any of these folks would be happy to talk to you. Any questions? Yep.
How does willpower affect the will? Like, I feel like very often people think that to quit or to change a behavior, everything has to be willpower, right? I need to get through this, and I feel like a lot of times it's better to just stop buying cookies, right? If you don't have cookies at home, you won't eat the cookies. If you change your route so you don't go in front of the store that sells cigarettes, you won't buy the cigarettes on your way back home. And I think this is way easier to do this way than the other way, right? Willpower, I think, is overrated in a lot of cases.
I think you're probably right to a certain extent. And the theories of behavior change that account for behavioral control get at that issue. For some people, that behavioral control is I can stop myself from doing it. for other people is I have to remove the exposures in order for me to sort of progress behaviorally. And really it's about how the particular individual views their ability to either withhold or remove themselves from the stimulus within the environment. So both can be simultaneously true. Great, thank you.